Sir Patrick retired as master. So the first one was in 1998. And Patrick's unable to be with us tonight. He's now 91. But he's nevertheless very interested to know that this was going on tonight, and thrilled that both Peter and Helen were going to be here and locked in Mortal Kombat.
It's okay, you don't have to rub it in. I think we'll spare the detail.
As a PTE student, and you'll be pleased to know, he'll be pleased to know, that two of his tutors are here tonight to keep their eye on them. And Johnson Bottles, and his third tutor. His third tutor, Wilfred Knapp, I'm sure will be watching from
He always was.
I was told that he was Alan Bullock's favourite pupil. Part of that might have been connected to start with, in that he is, of course, Herbert Morrison's grandson. Alan Bullock was very interested in that. But very rapidly, Alan saw the character that, that Peter was developing. He was JCR president, and some of you will have seen the new book that we've produced for our 50th anniversary. And there's a story told in there by Harriet Sargent of Peter, when the JCR elections were on, and he and his colleague were getting very, very agitated because they were counting the votes for this JCR election, and whichever way they counted them, they couldn't make them add up, and they thought that dastardly things had been going on, that somebody had pinched some votes, that something had been fixed, until in the end, Harriet Sargent, getting rather bored with this, stood up and realised she'd been sitting on the missing votes.
Very Harriet.
Now, Evan also read PP in Oxford 30 years ago, St John's College, and I'm afraid we haven't got your tutors here today. But a distinguished career has followed since the PP days, and we're really very much looking forward to hearing the two of you. So thank you for coming.
Roger, thank you very much indeed. Did you get a first, Peter?
No.
No. I did, actually. But you...
I mean, obviously, I have good reasons to explain why I didn't, but they'll come out in the wash.
But you failed your politics prelim, didn't you?
Yes, all right. I don't really... I mean, I wasn't a complete academic basket case, thank you very much, Evan. But I'm afraid during my first year here, I was overindulged by my tutors. They were just far too happy and excited to see me, far too tolerant of the constant driving that I did to London every week in order to pursue my political activities, which at the time were very strongly linked to Africa and to South Africa and Namibia in particular, because after I'd got my place here at St. Catharines, fairly early on in my sixth form, with a wonderful result that I only had to get two pass grades at A level and therefore promptly gave up geography, which was my third A level subject. I don't know whether that system still exists, but it was wonderful at the time. With this sort of new sense of luxury, I felt I decided I wouldn't go up to St. Catharines at all. I would instead go to Africa, and I, after a lot of pushing and shoving and writing of letters and a little bit of luck, I found myself living in northern Tanzania in the bush for a year before I came here. And I have to say that that whole experience sort of rather sort of flowed into and slightly dominated my first year here, with the result that I didn't do enough work.
No.
And I failed my politics prelim. You're absolutely right, but when I resat it, I flew through it with flying colours.
Yes, one, two, three. I mean, your career's been a lot of journeys, and in television land, it's always about a journey, you know, and you've had a lot of journeys, I mean, effectively from a sort of backstage to front of stage, from tactician originally to sort of elder statesman. I mean, a very youthful.
Yeah, I went through obviously that stage of being a master strategist.
Yeah,
and
yeah. No.
Elder statesman.
And also, I would surmise from unloved to
adored,
respected, appreciated, and appreciated, and in some cases, loved.
I think we could actually end the whole interview there. I think that's a very fitting point.
What I wanted to do. Is talk a little bit. What we'll do is we'll talk for a bit up here, 40 minutes maybe, and then we'll take some questions. But what I did want to do was to just, in a way, look back at New Labour and the New Labour government, which is your achievement. What do you think the legacy is of that government that you're most proud of?
Well, first of all, it wasn't sort of my achievement. There were a large number of people who were
but you were very
walking roles, you know, cameo appearances, Tony Blair, for example. I think when I look back on the government, I feel pleased by the fact that, notwithstanding the sort of circumstances, the financial crash and the problems that ensued from that. During the period of the Labour government as a whole, from 1997 to 2010, we did in fact see our GDP and our productivity growth in this country sort of transformed, with the result that the economy was a third larger at the end of our time in office than it was in 1997. Secondly, I am proud of the fact that during the course of the new Labour government, I would say that we as a country, as a society, became a more sort of progressive, inclusive, tolerant society. I'm proud of the fact that we invested on a scale and latterly with a detail in our public services, which made up for the loss of investment that they had experienced in the sort of 10, 15 years before, but also I think equally importantly, embedded in our public services a sort of a better culture of sort of delivery, of discipline, of accountability to those who are using the public services than had been the case originally. We certainly attacked poverty in this country effectively. We didn't eliminate poverty, but we certainly attacked it more effectively than the government in Britain had before or after our period in office. And I would say that outside the country, the country became more settled in its sort of relationship and membership of the European Union, a sort of stability which has now been sort of rather disrupted by the return to office of the Conservatives, but we can come back to that. I think further afield than Europe, I think we had some early successes in the policies of, I don't know how I'd call it, sort of interventionism, liberal interventionism.
Liberal intervention, yes. Which
certainly showed success in Sierra Leone, Kosovo,
Sierra Leone,
Kosovo.
There was Kosovo.
And I think Iraq. Iraq came after, and it may even be shown that when we look back at our time in Afghanistan, that wasn't a complete success either.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot there.
So that's what I'm pleased
that's
about.
And particularly the sort of more, if you like, the country more at ease with itself and the progressive politics. I can understand that one being on your list. One has to, though, listen to that list and ask whether really quite a lot of the things that look like achievements in, say, 2005 or 2007, whether in light of the crash, and that it's whether or not you blame Gordon Brown or blame the Labour government for the crash. Mm. Personally, I think it's pointless.
Which I think would be
hard to sustain that argument. So let's agree for the moment that we wouldn't blame anyone for the crash. But it's when you take into account the crash, whether you just have to subtract two or three of the achievements you've mentioned. I mean, on the economy, really the growth rate over Labour's period was no better than over the period before. It was slightly faster for some years and then hugely negative for some years. And when you add them all up, it sort of takes you back. to where we would have expected to be all along, really. It's hard to see what the economic legacy is.
I think the economic legacy, this is sort of pre-crash, and we can talk about the crash, which is a huge external shock, obviously, to the economy. But we can come back to that. I would say that during our time in government, Britain became a better place in which to do business. I think the supply side of the economy, through the investment in education, universities, science, technologies, research and development, certainly strengthened during our time. I think that the physical infrastructure of the economy, if not transformed, certainly had decisions taken whilst we were in office.
Less dilapidated at the end than before, no doubt about it.
Even more so now, I mean, we're seeing Crossrail emerging in London. That wasn't a decision taken by the president.
No, clearly.
A decision taken by ours.
But all these things, and so on.
So I think
these great things on the supply side, they should manifest themselves in the long-term increase in the growth rate, but we haven't really seen it. I think if you look back over the last 10 years, one might have to worry that the kind of the British business model, what we do, the way we pay our way, we let the deindustrialisation go too far. Wouldn't you agree with that?
I do agree with that.
We didn't...
But we believed in a market economy, you see, and we judged that these are decisions, or these were sort of levers that were not available to the government to pull, or buttons to push. The fact is that we developed specialisms in services, in particular financial services, which gave us, I think, a rather distorted view of the underlying strength and performance of our economy.
And I think it's understandable that one
financial
got that
services sector
view.
Also gave us colossal revenues Treasury, which when they evaporated, when the crisis left our public finances in a very bad state.
Yeah, but it does look as though... I mean, the south of England has a business model that clearly works for the south of England. It's a commercial services hub. It knows what its place in the world is. Inner London is... hugely productive, twice as productive per head as the average for the rest
certainly
of the country.
What we haven't done,
in a way, is sort out what large parts of the country do, how they keep themselves fully employed in the absence of public sector. I mean, I think I would be perhaps more worried than you were in marking the economy as an achievement that actually it was just more of the same, really.
Well, I don't agree with you. I don't accept that premise, because I think that we did things and saw things happen in the economy that strengthened our underlying performance and our productivity. But in, as you know, when I came back to the government in 2008, I had to come back because of the financial crisis and the political crisis that was going on in the party and the government as well at that time, I had my eyes opened both on the continent in Europe but also elsewhere to what governments could do more effectively to change and improve the performance and the prospects for our economy. In other words, I judged that we had taken too much to heart the sort of New Labour dictum that ministers and markets don't mix. That once you see a minister moving towards a market and trying to influence it in one way or another, it would only distort it, it would only blunt it and get in the way. My view when I came back and in the autumn of 2008, and I had already been asked to deliver a lecture, the Hugo Young Memorial Lecture, and I did so on the subject of markets and ministers, effectively, and why I thought that governments, sensible, pragmatic, selectively acting governments, could do more influence or put incentives in place or add to the investment that was taking place in different markets, sectors and technologies from which we would draw larger future growth. And I embarked on my policies of industrial activism,
more,
as
well,
I
called
them.
It did tilt more active, didn't
which,
it?
Which we could and should have done a lot more of at the beginning of the government than simply saving it up for 2 years at the end.
And just looking at it today, if you were running that department today, would you be sort of where Michael Heseltine is, Lord Heseltine is at the moment? You know, he came up with this great package of growth measures, very concerned about the great cities of Northern England and their role and what they need.
Yeah, I would be
100% really.
I talked to Michael quite a lot during his inquiry and his review of government policies. We spent hours talking together. And certainly, his outlook, his perspective is exactly the same as mine.
Not even a cigarette paper between you, really, I wouldn't have thought.
I would not have axed the regional development agencies and set up local economic... But then he wouldn't have either. He's not really a Tory at all.
Well, there's that, or there's another obvious way of reading that. On the economy, when I look back on that government and read your book about it and his book
you
about
did actually
it.
Read it
your book I did read it I did read you said on the radio I didn't read it I did read it I gave up a whole weekend of my life reading that book.
You gave more than a passing
how do you
impersonation of somebody when you interviewed me of not having read it.
I had read
never mind
the
go
book.
On, I
accept read the book. Anyway, I was about to say that the real hero of the last 3 years of Labour government, I'm wondering whether you agree with this, was Alistair Darling.
Yeah.
He was I think history will judge Alistair Darling well, do you think?
Yes, I think they will judge him as somebody who had a sort of fairly clear, practical, pragmatic, sensible view of what the government had to do in response to the financial crisis. I think he will be praised for acting as he did in respect of the banks and the avoidance of their collapse, which would have sent systemic repercussions not only through our economy but that of the rest of the world, which would have cast us even further down than we were. I think that he came into his own, though, not in the full 3 years of his time there, but in his final year. He found his...
He stood up to Gordon in the last year, didn't he?
Not quite how I was going to put it. but I think he found a sort of a confidence, which is why, as you know,
the confidence
from his
the man
book and
who
mine...
He tried to sack, but he couldn't, and then it's all... there's a sort of matter of dispute, or not dispute's the wrong word, but just a sort of recorded history. Some say the rescue of the banks, the recapitalisation of the banks, that action, which was, I think most would now acknowledge, dynamic and necessary and quick. Some say it was Gordon Brown, and others think it was Alistair Darling. Who, just to help us here, who was the person who really made that happen? Who should history judge as the one who stopped the British economy imploding?
You certainly have to credit Alistair Darling and the Treasury with sort of working out the plan, applying the detail, taking the advice, and providing the sort of, I don't know, the framework or the infrastructure for that decision. You would have to credit Gordon Brown with the drive and the risk-taking involved in implementing it. And there were others who were
around and about. Freety and everybody.
Jeremy Hayward,
Peter Sands.
But I would say that it was a very good demonstration model of effective
government.
Cabinet government.
The reason why I mentioned Alistair is Alistair Darling was I wanted to get on to a second topic, looking back at Labour, which was a topic about honesty and spin and the way politicians present themselves. And one of the things I like about Alistair Darling is he seems to be a very straightforward kind of guy. And he famously said, and got into terrible trouble with the Prime Minister for saying this is the worst economic crisis for 60 years, and was sort of criticised, when actually it was, and he was right. And it was probably right to sort of say to people that was the case. So let's talk a little bit, move off the economy, let's talk a bit about honesty and dishonesty. When you look back at Labour government, they put quite a lot of effort into presentation. You were a large part of that. And when I look at it, I get, you know how some people get cosmetic surgery, and then they get more cosmetic surgery, and they get more cosmetic surgery, and then you look at them and say, you are so ugly as a result of the surgery. You would have been more attractive if you'd just stayed as you were. And it's so pitiful to think you've got all that effort to make yourself look beautiful, and the thing that's not stopping you look beautiful is the effort. And I sometimes thought that was the most annoying thing about New Labour was the presentation. And by the end, it had really given presentation a bad name. It was the sort of noble art of communication had been manipulated and undermined. I wonder whether, just looking back now, I'll flatter you a bit, because in your book, you actually demonstrate that you're probably one of the few people in the party who understood the limits of communication and had to keep saying to Gordon Brown, Gordon Brown's view was that he had all the policies right, it was just the communication that was wrong, and you had to keep explaining to him, Gordon, it's not the communication that's wrong, it's that there isn't a core to what you're doing, and we need to work that out, and the communication will look after itself. So in some ways, you were the one who understood the limits of communication. But reflect, if you would, on that whole, if you like, 13-year experiment in that style of very professional PR?
Well, a number of points. The first, which is the least important, is that my responsibility for the presentation and communications of the party and New Labour in government came to an end on election day. I was responsible for the campaign in the run-up to the campaign.
You mean in 97?
In 97, yeah. I wasn't responsible for the presentation of the government, yeah, and its communication.
We don't really believe that, by the way, but let's accept that. Yeah, yeah.
Well, it has a germ of truth.
Yeah,
anyway.
Obviously,
I don't want to exaggerate the claim, but the truth is that the baton was passed to others. Secondly, you have to remember that when I became the communications director of the Labour Party in 1985, when I was, you know, a 32-year-old who knew absolutely nothing about communications or campaigning or public relations or advertising, literally almost at all, but was lucky enough to find a chap who did know about all these things, Philip Gould. And we sort of then went, sort of marched in tandem from that moment on. At that stage, the Labour Party was undergoing a near-death experience. Mm. I mean, it was a near-death experience in the mid-1980s that presentation and communications couldn't possibly cure, but which was a reasonable start. So, you know, actually knowing, you know, when the evening television news bulletins were going to be screened was a start. I arrived at the PR media department office of the Labour Party and I asked about the sort of news schedules, and the chap I asked said, 1 minute, I'll just go off and get a copy of the Radio Times. and brought it to me, actually. Now, in the 1987 general election, which was the first election campaign I directed, the famous Red Rose election, showed that you could go some way in spray painting this product, this battered old car called the Labour Party, but actually you had to re-engineer the car itself if you were going to make it roadworthy and sellable to others. And the truth is that although stage by stage, under Neil Kinnock and under John Smith, you know, we did sort of recover the Labour Party and move it more into a sort of viable centre ground of British politics and make it electable, I mean, the real sort of transformation and the real thrill of the new Labour Party emerged only when Tony Blair became its leader. And what I think Tony Blair gave us was a way of approaching politics that represented an electorally viable and principled path that modern social democrats could take, where we could win elections or fight elections not despite our policies, but with a chance of winning them because of our policies, where we went into the campaign proclaiming our belief in our policies rather than being slightly ashamed of them.
Embarrassed about them.
Now, that was the sort of transformation of the Labour Party from 1985 to 1997.
The engine of the car changed, but at the same time, it was constantly being given spray jobs. And you were very stung by the 92 election, which seemed to be an election, and I think probably the most memorable and important election the country had in many respects, because it was the one where Labour thought, there are forces against us, and we just have to be. A, we do have to change the engine, but we have to be very disciplined about the message and not allowing people to hold us hostage by misinterpreting things that we say.
But that wasn't the
so
most
became very controlling
ever.
After
this
that.
This is very important. This is very, very important. That was not the main lesson taken from 1992. The main lesson from 92 was that we could not win with all the best presentation and communication skills in the world without different policies.
Okay.
And what the reason why the New Labour won on such a with such a landslide in 1997, and why I would believe we in the main had a successful period in government, was not because of our presentation,
but because
of our policies.
I would agree with that. But let me ask you this then: looking back on it, does presentation actually make any difference at all?
Yes,
if we just sacked all the presenters and we said, but don't the public judge you? Don't the public judge you on the long-term performance? And in the end, you know,
Evan, let's not be naive about this. Let's be grown up. We live in a world of 24-hour, 24/7, non-stop satellite. Mm-hmm. TV and reporting. Mm-hmm. We have news channels, BBC, Sky, mm-hmm. and the rest, who are pouring out news and have to be sort of fed 24 hours a day. They are not people who are prepared to wait for a government to sort of reflect on, you know, how it might present.
And it would be
policy
bad
in this, or respond to that crisis here, or this setback there, or this hiccup somewhere else. They want instant answers, instant explanations, instant apologies, instant everything. Now, if you did not have a well-oiled communications machine that was able to cope with that sort of cacophony of sort of media noise that surrounds you and almost drowns your every sort of waking thought and moment, then you would swiftly go down the plug hole. It's a fact of life, I'm afraid.
I wonder whether in the end the cacophony was actually distracting the people who should have been making the long-term decisions rather than them owning the process. They were distracted by it, deceived by their own nonsense. I mean, you had some very, very interesting examples, didn't you? Particularly under Gordon Brown. Gordon Brown apparently didn't understand that when he abolished the 10p tax rate, there would be a bunch of low-income losers from that. And The reason was that the Treasury tried to cover up that there were low-income losers. They published a table of winners. They didn't publish a table of losers. All of us knew there were losers, so we said there are going to be losers. Gordon Brown persisted in saying there are only winners.
But that's spin. But
the point was that
that's not communication.
The only people who are ever fooled by the spin are the people who are uttering it. And everybody else, in the end, is just wearily kind of... And it, in the end, doesn't make any difference. You know, why
bother?
I could
give you many more examples of... of spin than you have at your disposal. And spin, more often than not, backfires.
Yeah.
Because it's unpicked by people. You know, you have instant analysis, you have very good people by means of digital technology and communications swiftly brought into studios and informing presenters like you, and one by one, threads are pulled, and before you know where you are, the whole thing unravels. So spin doesn't usually work. But that is not, however, a reason for being a bad communicator, a bad presenter of your policy, or a plausible, attractive...
Brilliant. You've made a very important distinction between a clarity of communication. Good communication is not speaking bullshit the whole time and trying to persuade people that black is white.
Especially when in the case of New Labour, in my view, we didn't have any need to spew out bullshit. We had perfectly good policies and explanations and justifications for what we're doing. I mean, if you want to know about spin, go back to the Labour Party in the 1980s. Mm. I mean, you were... talking about putting lipstick on the pig. I mean, when I produced policy statements in the 1980s, I remember the manifesto in 1987, that the margin was, the white margin down the side was enlarged so that the text was sort of squeezed somewhere near the outer edge of the manifesto. And down the margin, I put sort of headlines, which I chose. I didn't write the manifesto, because that was the job of the policy department, God help us, in the 1980s. But I was responsible for writing the sort of little statements that went down the rather the large quotes, margin, which I hope people would focus on rather than the text. now, definition of spin?
Yeah.
Okay, but we were fighting for our survival, thank you very much. And I feel blameless.
Lance Price, in his book about life as a spin doctor under Labour, I think it's called Spin Doctor's Diary or something, there's a point in the book, he's talking nonsense the whole time, spinning away. And then there's a point where he admits, then I told a lie. I actually didn't just talk waffle or obfuscate. I actually told a direct lie. I can't even remember what it was, actually. But
very unfortunate.
Did you ever tell a sort of a factual lie? Yeah. No, not of the kind I like and respect Gordon Brown, he's a great prime minister, or anything. But with the book making, because that's a matter of no, seriously, that's the sort of thing you could say. But did you ever tell a factual lie, like he wasn't there when he was there, or?
As it happens in a number of areas, on a number of occasions, I do happen to think that Gordon Brown
was quite
effective as Prime Minister. Did I ever lie? I never lied about policy. I don't think I ever lied about anything important. I did occasionally wipe out or select certain things... chiefly in the 1980s, but my God, there was a lot to overlook, omit, and wipe out in the 1980s. I mean, we used to have these sort of meetings of the National Executive Committee of the party, which in those days really did govern and drive the party. And as you know, the party was divided. We had Tony Benn and Dennis Skinner and all their acolytes on the National Executive under Neil. And each decision was sort of, you know, was on a knife edge. Let me give you one example. The Labour Party in 1980, after the 1987 general election, decided to write something called Aims and Values. And this was an early attempt of sort of an early clause for moment where we were trying to recast and re-communicate and popularise our aims and values as a party, you know, for a new era, post-Thatcher era of politics. And it was effectively to, you know, push clause four, you know, out of the window. And we got on famously. It was written with great sort of verve, and it was eventually pulled together and put in front of the National Executive Committee. It was voted on as usual, 16 in favour, 13 against, with 3 abstentions, the usual sort of NEC vote on something like that. And I thought, my God, this is absolutely wonderful. I can't wait to race out to announce, the new aims and values of the modern Labour Party. Whereupon Dennis Skinner put his hand up and said, hold on a moment, Mr. Chairman. I would like to move that, having agreed the new aims and values, we should reprint Part 4, Clause 4 of the party constitution within the document, just to show that we have, and my heart sort of fell. And I looked across the table at Neil, who was sort of thinking, how the hell can I get out of this? He was literally stuck for words. He did not know how to confront this moment of acute danger. And I wrote him a note very quickly. I said, agree it, I'll deal with it. And I dealt with it by deciding that when the final printed version of the New Aims and Values was published, I would place Part 4, Clause 4, in the inside cover of the bound document. But that, of course, would be in months or so's time. In the meantime, I was going to take down to the waiting press the New Aims and Values as agreed, minus its cover, and therefore, tragically, minus Part 4, Clause 4, that would, in due course, be printed on the inside cover. Now, is
You're
that
so
lying?
Clever. No, that isn't lying. That isn't lying. That's really very clever.
Thank you very much.
I do want to come to the audience, so just a couple of other things. There's a bit of a debate. It's actually a debate, I think, primarily between David Miliband and Ed Balls at the moment. This reflects on honesty and the economy, brings together the two topics we've talked about.
Yeah.
About how much Labour should admit to mistakes in its period of office, how frank it should be in reassessing what it did. And I, as I understand it, that the Balls line is, if you sort of open up too much, you open yourself to ridicule, it's overstated, you then... It's called a gaffe, and the papers say, see, we admit we screwed up, and this kind of thing. And David Miliband, I think, takes the view that until you've got a good narrative of what went right and what went wrong, and it feels like a credible one, no one's ever going to really trust you on the economy again. Whose side are you on in that debate?
Both. Both.
Discuss.
Discuss. I completely understand Ed Balls's sensitivity because I think that the claims that are made about the Labour government sort of over-investing, over-spending, resulting in too high a tax take, to finance it, excessive borrowing also to finance it, leading to an unsustainable deficit, is simply not warranted and not justified. I really don't think anyone can claim in the period immediately before the financial crisis, with a public spending taking a proportion of GDP, which I accept moved from 36% at the beginning of our time in office to 46%, was nonetheless sort of excessive and unsupportable.
Well, the planned rise was to 42, so I mean, by the end, it's going up higher.
Okay, but there was also planned that spending would go down.
Yeah.
And that was planned. It was foreseen that the rate of increase in public spending, after we had gone through all the sort of investment in hospitals and schools and the like, would come down after, I think, 2007, 2008, possibly a year earlier than that. And given that at the time of the financial crisis, also our debt to GDP ratio was better than most other members of the G8. We had a deficit, I think, of something in the region of 2-3%.
I hear what you're saying. Clearly went wrong.
We all know what went wrong. Shock to the economy, a financial crisis and a banking failure that resulted in three things. One, a dirty great credit crunch. Yeah. In an economy which I fully accept had been driven too far and too long by excessive credit and too loose a monetary policy. I accept that, but that I would contend was more the responsibility of the Bank of England than the government. Secondly, an evaporation of revenues from the financial and banking sector to the economy, which left our public finances in a very bad state indeed. combined with a loss of confidence, a collapse in demand.
But I didn't want to go back into the economic. I didn't want to go back into the economic debate.
But hold on a moment.
But in what way do you agree with David Miliband?
It's not as simple as that. What you're asking me to do is to accept responsibility on behalf of the Labour government for the financial crisis and the ensuing economic problems. And the reason I'm not going to accept that, and I think Ed Balls is right not to accept it, because until the crisis struck, our public finances, our borrowing requirement, were not unsoundly based. We were, however, and I fully accept this, overexposed as an economy to the financial sector. Mm. I mean, our dependency on the financial sector, our exposure to the financial sector as a sort of proportion of our economy and GDP was so great and too large that when the crisis struck, we were more damaged and harmed than other European economies at the time. I accept that. Now, was it our fault that the financial sector sort of grew so large and so successfully, generated colossal revenues for the Treasury, which financed our public investment in services and infrastructure, transforming the health service? Was it our fault that we had such a large and successful financial sector? Should we have curbed it? Should we have reined it in? Should we have taken measures to sort of shrink our financial sector after 1997? I don't remember a single living soul suggesting that we should have done that. And I think nobody with an ounce of sense would say that we should or that we could have done that differently from 1997 onwards.
But the frustrating thing is that you haven't given a narrative about the good years and the bad years that sounds entirely credible. You haven't, effectively, what you've tried to do in what you're outlining is take the credit for the good years without taking any blame for the bad years. I'm happy for you not to have the blame for the bad years, but then I'm not willing to give you all the credit for the good years. Those were inflated financial bubble, credit boom, housing market excess, and you're taking the credit for that and saying, well, we spent the money on the health service.
They weren't only those things. You are quite right in observing, and I fully accept, what this sort of excessive supply of credit to the economy did was to produce inflated asset prices and bubbles that created a mistaken or exaggerated view of the sources of our growth and its sustainability. Yeah. There was a wrong view was taken of the economy.
And that's what now, needs to be said, isn't it, by the Labour Party now in order to have credibility in the next phase.
Did anyone take a different view? No. Was the Bank of England who was responsible for monetary
that
policy
sounds offensive.
At the time? No, I'm not.
Until
I'm
you
not,
actually say,
no,
by the way,
no,
we can't blame the Bank of England, we can't blame the newspapers or the Conservatives.
Why should I say because you shouldn't blame? Why should I say that you shouldn't blame the Bank of England when they were asleep on the job? I'm damned if I'm going to exonerate the Bank of England and its governor, who was reappointed by us in from any responsibility. You want me, and you're being a journalist now rather than an objective analyst and commentator. you want me to dump on the government in a way that will produce a good headline.
No,
precisely.
It's not.
Yes, you are. Yes, you do.
I
want me
a
to
narrative
do that.
That sounds credible. For
look,
the
I'll
crash.
Give you. I'm trying to give you a narrative, which is
it wasn't
which
fault.
Is. Well, I don't believe that we did create the banking crisis, the financial crisis in 2007-08. And I haven't heard anyone who argues that the Labour government did, unless you want to do so.
No, I'm not.
Well,
arguing.
Then what are you arguing about?
I'm arguing that you can't then take the credit for the good years. That's quite simple. You can have one or the other, but
you can't
say it was great 5 years and then it all went pear-shaped.
It's a complete non sequitur. If you're asking me what we did right during those 5 years, I think I have done enough to rehearse
that's
what
fine.
We did.
Yeah.
If you're also asking me whether monetary policy and the provision of credit in the economy was got completely right, I've already said to you it was not.
No, okay.
I mean, the fact that that was more the responsibility of the Independent Bank of England than the Treasury is neither here nor there. But I mean, it's a factor. I'm sorry, it's a factor. Now, you want to produce, Mandelson says, we got it wrong. I would be perfectly happy to continue to give you a fair and balanced narrative of what we did. I've already accepted, for example, that we could and should have done more to bring about a rebalancing of the economy, both between sectors and geographically. I'm not saying that we had a silver bullet or a magic wand, incidentally, to wave over the economy, but we could
have done
made more. A greater difference than we realised if we had started earlier pursuing the policies that I did when I came back in 2008. And I could give you other examples. I could point to the weakness of this system of financial sector and banking regulation that we introduced. Theoretically, very sound tripartite arrangement, which was absolutely fine on paper until the crisis actually came, and the three points of that triangle waited for the other to take the initiative in responding to the crisis.
Not brilliant.
So I could go on if you want, pointing out different sort of areas of wrong judgment or weak judgment or inactivity or whatever, but I do not think that detracts A, from our overall economic record, and I certainly don't think it delivers an indictment on the government for producing the financial crisis when it came in 2008, because it didn't.
Peter, thank you very much.